gets really important to show that we can seem to modify frailty, the concept of frailty in multiple sclerosis. And I think that to me is one of the take homes and how best, you know, now the questions become how best to do it, what's the mechanism of action, all these other questions that we can ask. But first we had to show that it is possible. So I think to me, that's really exciting.
Welcome to RehabCast, the official podcast of the American Congress of Rehabilitation Medicine and the Archives of PM&R. I'm your host, Dr. Bill Niehaus from the University of Colorado. Today, we're exploring an innovative approach to managing frailty in people with multiple sclerosis, one that combines something as familiar as a treadmill with the power of virtual reality. Our guests are Jake Snosoff, professor and associate dean at the University of Kansas Medical Center, and Toby Zanotto, an assistant professor of occupational therapy also at the University of Kansas Medical Center. Their work looks at engaging patients through immersive, gamified experiences can lead to meaningful improvements in both physical and cognitive frailty. We start the conversation with Jake describing the experience of being a participant in their study.
For the person who's experiencing this, they're on a treadmill, they're walking, they have different colored sponges on their feet, and they're looking at a TV screen. Tell me how they're perceiving the non-immersive but still virtual reality experience.
If we think about what people do in, you know, fitness facilities, often we're on the treadmill, we're watching TV, you know, every once in a while you try to read the banner on the bottom and you fall off. But for the most part, rarely do we go on the treadmill voluntarily and go for a long time, or at least not the average person. We're usually looking for that distraction. And this immersive, this virtual reality, we're tracking the feet and they're looking to avoid these obstacles. There were puddles and little barriers to step over. And they would give feedback. The screen would essentially flash red if they didn't clear the obstacle.
Is that patient experience, the gamification part of this, were they shooting for scores? Were they like, I only had 5 mistakes this time? I'm curious how you guys witnessed that patient experience.
Yeah, so it's very typical that when a patient starts exercising using a gait pattern, so this virtual reality system, so typically they will have a lot of failures in passing the obstacles in the beginning, which can be quite frustrating actually in the beginning, but then as they gain skill through the whole process, they really treat the rate of past obstacles as the extra gaming component. So it becomes more and more challenging, and there are other ways of making the intervention more challenging as well. So, for instance, we can play with environmental aspects. We can add fog to their walk, for instance, or we can using more complicated settings as part of training.
Yeah, I think it's an important point Toby raises, that the intervention, the virtual reality, was progressive. So we actually also increased the walking speed. So, you know, we would check the walking speed because we don't want people walking too slow or too fast, right? So we matched this, we individualized it as best we could. And then also based on the error rate, we would increase the cognitive difficulty, or what we perceived as the cognitive difficulty. Because we believe, and I think from a rehab standpoint, there's a sweet spot, right? You want it to be challenging enough so they're working, but not so challenging that they don't show up the next time, right? So that's really what we were trying to do with that. In the paper, at least the original paper, we detail that a little bit more.
That's great. Thinking through this analysis now and kind of how that kind of came together, I'm always curious to ask people, you know, you do the intervention, you get things going. There are things in that process that are easier than you thought they would be. And then inevitably there's the stuff that you thought would be super easy to accomplish that ends up being like the impossible boulder that you weren't even expecting. And I always find it's helpful to share what those things are so that other researchers out there know that they're not the only ones.
So I think in terms of characterizing frailty, for instance, I think that was a relatively easy aspect for me because that's my background. So in this regard, we essentially leveraged data that were already collected as part of this VR4MS study. And what we did, we calculated three different frailty index measures. Now, without going into details, one frailty measure mainly focused on overall frailty, whereas we also had two measures that focused more on the physical aspects of frailty and cognitive frailty, for lack of a better word. So the main core of the analysis consisted of evaluating the effects of the two interventions, so the treadmill training plus virtual reality, as opposed to treadmill training only, on these measures of frailty. So that was something that went well in my experience. I don't know if you want to share.
Yeah, you know, I think for the parent trial, I think one of the biggest issues was always recruitment. You think you have enough patient base until you try to do especially an exercise intervention, and then, you know, suddenly your patient base becomes much smaller. The parent trial again we actually ran into COVID. So everything that we thought we knew went out the window. And especially with the MS population, some of the precautions we had to take were, you know, I wouldn't say different, but we had to pay attention to all these precautions. Luckily, we had a wonderful team. It was actually international RCT. So we had challenges with that, but we were able to pull it out. These secondary analyses, I think, were perhaps what we didn't expect, right? We don't think of these secondary analyses at least I didn't, with the original grant, the original papers, but it's with gifted young scientists like Dr. Zanotto that add nuance to it and allow us to ask more questions. You know, I think one thing that's really important, and I want to make sure I get this in there, you know, this notion of frailty and multiple sclerosis is just emerging. We think it makes sense to look at it. But up to this paper, I think this is the first paper that actually shows it can change. So there's limitations to the paper. Again, it's a secondary analysis, so we didn't necessarily recruit only frail people, which, you know, can be interpreted one way or the other. But I think it's really important to show that we can seem to modify frailty, the concept of frailty in multiple sclerosis. And I think that, to me, is one of the take homes, and how best, you know, now the questions become how best to do it, what's the mechanism of action, all these other questions that we can ask. But first, we had to show that it is possible. So I think, to me, that's really exciting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're kind of giving us the punchline here, which is great. No, it's good. It's good, because that's really empowering, right? More often than not, I don't know, you can get stuck in these traps of these significant disease processes are impacting individuals, or it's a progressive disease process and we're not necessarily expecting things to change. And you can kind of fall into that kind of groove of thought. And these are the things that really help pop us out. When you talk about this, or kind of getting people into looking at the paper, I think it'd be helpful to explain a little bit. So when we look at the actual intervention, and then you looked at those outcomes that we talked about, the frailty index, breaking it down into cognitive and physical, and I think it's worth kind of talking the listeners through that and the interesting parts on how the I'm paraphrasing, both generally got better.
So when we looked at the effects of the two interventions, we basically noted that both interventions resulted in a reduction of overall frailty and physical frailty to a very similar extent, to a very similar degree, whereas only participants who were randomized to treadmill training plus virtual reality improved the cognitive frailty score. So that was really the main difference between the two interventions. So we all found that regardless of the intervention, whether it was treadmill training alone or treadmill training augmented by virtual reality, about 1 in 5 participants not only reduced their frailty index, but they also exhibited a transition in frailty status. So for instance, from severely frail to moderately frail, or from moderately frail to non-frail. And this may not seem so significant because it's only 1 in 5 participants, but when we consider that the training duration was only 6 weeks, I think this tells a lot about the potential of exercise-based rehabilitation to reduce frailty levels in people with MS. So it is very much possible that if we prolong the training intervention by another 6 weeks, for instance, we would have found a much higher proportion of frailty transitions.
Yeah, and that's not nothing. 1 in 5, 20%. Like, that's a good number needed to treat. You know, there's a lot of medicines out there that would love that kind of number if that's the intervention that they're working on and putting out there. I want you to dig in a little bit more into that, changing the category of frailty. Like, what, from based using this model, what is mild, moderate? Like, give us some expansion for people that are less familiar with this scale, how big of a change that actually is.
Sure. So there are several cutoff values that we can use to kind of categorize people that are not frail, moderately frail, and severely frail using the frailty index. So typically a cutoff value of 0.36. Above that value, we have severely frail participants. Between 0.24 and 0.36, we have usually a moderately frail part of the population. And then if they have a frailty index that is less than 0.24, they're usually considered non-frail. Now, one important caveat is that these cutoff scores are taken from the geriatric literature. And I think there will be, in the future, a greater need for better identifying what are the exact cutoff values in the MS population.
And maybe paint that picture, like if you're a therapist and you're thinking about what a mildly frail person looks like, that's someone that needs what type of assistance, or I know this is extrapolating, this is beyond your paper, but I'm trying to paint this picture for the listeners as to what that change actually means. So if you're a PT and you say, there's this paper out there, getting on a treadmill 3 times a week for 6 weeks for a certain amount of time can make a difference. And if they're a responder to this, what does that change potentially, extrapolating asterisks, it's not what the paper says, might they expect if they were a good person for this intervention?
Yeah, Bill, I think like one way to look at this or to think about it is as we're changing those categories from severely to moderately, especially, we're taking people that are, I'm trying to think of the right word, but like are lack robustness, right? They're the people that walk in and you're almost afraid to work with. You don't want to push them, right? You don't want to make anything worse. And they're going from that to being one of the, on the more robust side that you think that you're going to be able to make it, you know, I got to be careful how I say this, but you know, you're, there's more movement from that. They look less, and again, I'm using probably inappropriate terms here, they look less sickly, right? Like they truly look less frail. And we know this, you know, in if you're working with people with MS, you know, we can talk about the problems of the traditional scales like the EDSS and how they might, but you can have someone that has the same EDSS score and you know from a just your clinical experience, you know, this person is healthier than that person, right? We're moving them along that to the healthier side of that. We're not improving their disability status from an EDS standpoint, but what we're showing is that they're within that component, within that EDSS scale, they're doing much more, they're much more vigorous, they're much more rigorous in their ability, right? That's really what I think we're improving upon, is that, and it's an overall, it's not necessarily that you're gonna see it only in their gait speed, you know, it's not a, we're not saying they're getting 20% faster. We're saying that they're getting, you know, again, Toby will probably yell at me for this, but maybe we can think of it as like 20% healthier, right? And with, you know, with a caveat and asterisks around what health means, but I think that's really what we're starting to see.
Yeah, and I think we can go in both directions. So for instance, for those patients that are severely frail, the focus will be to bring them back to moderately frail or non-frail, but it's also very important at the same time to working with patients that are mildly frail, and in that case, the objective will be kind of like delay the onset of frailty rather than bringing them back. So I think when we're talking about frailty rehabilitation, both directions are very important.
Yep. Absolutely, and that's that whole MS model, right? It's a chronic progressive disease, and our job is to slow that process down and try and prolong those changes for as long as possible. We're prob- like within our lifetimes, it would be great if we could reverse the process. But I don't know. I've been doing this long enough that that feels harder to achieve than at least slowing that slope down. And so whether it's through disease-modifying medications or interventions like these to kind of keep people, their function, their frailty index, however you're counting that, to make that a slower process and give them improved, ideally, quality of life through that process to just help them do more, great. The other thing that I really liked your figure three in the paper, because it, like the bars and the air bars and stuff, like you can see the changes and all that's good, but I really appreciated you taking the time to put that one together in terms of giving some context to who really wasn't quite responding great to this type of intervention and who really, really responded to this and who had gained in the right direction and what that looks like. So thanks for putting that together. And looking at it, you get into the treadmill training with additive VR and you see people that are responders. It's kind of 50-50 for both groups. Both are moving in that right direction, and that VR tipped it over to that 50% line where 24 of the people were responding to that intervention, where 20 just didn't quite seem to make a change in that frailty index. And that's even better than that 1 in 5 picture potentially, which is great.
Another way that we've looked at frailty, and again, this is probably a little bit extension of this paper, you know, one thing that we've thought of that we've begun to explore is, does frailty give us an indication of who's going to respond to the intervention? So from a clinical standpoint, again, you have a patient that you want to help. Knowing what intervention to use with that person, I think, is really important. And I think as a field, we don't always know what to do. You know, I know there's that clinical knowledge, but as far as this intervention for this person, you know, we are looking at that idea, does frailty help us understand non-responder, or do we need to target the frailty and then do the next intervention? And those are some of the questions I think we're beginning to address that I think will help drive the field forward.
Absolutely. And it gets into the clinician, therapist, physician, whatever. And it takes them a long time with a given patient population to feel like they have the acumen to start to make those calls. Otherwise, not that they're coloring by numbers, they're doing good work, they're doing their best, but the more with interventions like this or things that give it a little bit more of a tangible feel, it helps them decrease that time needed to start to steer people in the right direction towards the thing that might help them the most or gives them the best odds. I really like this paper. I want to keep talking about it. Are there other highlights and things that you guys want to make sure we pull out? Surprising things, things we haven't already talked about or addressed?
So I think in going into the kind of future research perspective, because this is such a novel, relatively new area of investigation, I think there is a better need to understand what are the biological underpinnings of frailty and how MS-related frailty may differ from the frailty we observe in older adults, for instance. So I think going forward, yes, there will be a need to explore what are the root causes of frailty in people with MS, and also how it differs from a neurological disability, for instance.
And I think building off that, Toby, I think the other idea is to understand how it changes over time, right? Because this paper, we show that, we can improve it, but, you know, what happens, someone comes in, they have a certain level of frailty or a certain amount of frailty, what happens when they come back a year later or 6 months later? At this point, you know, from a research standpoint, we can't answer that. We have cross-sectional data. That's the best we have. And I think tracking this over time, and again, looking to see, you know, if a crystal ball would be great, but do changes in frailty predict changes in disability? That would be incredibly worthwhile for the field to know. We don't know that, and I'm not saying it does, but I think that's it's a worthwhile research question for us to pursue.
And thinking through, with a medicine, you want to give the lowest effective dose. So is it 6 weeks? Is it 3 weeks? Is it 12 weeks? What happens if they do those 6 weeks, What do they look like a year later versus someone that can maintain that type of intervention over time? All those variations are ripe for future investigations and things. So I think you have plenty of work ahead of you.
Yep, we do.
All right. I have some lightning round questions. These are just to get to know the both of you, to make you not just the researcher, but more than. Before I jump into those, these are harmless. You can skip them, or one of them, or whatever. You can both answer them. You can hop back and forth. It's whatever feels right. I also, like, you guys have a chance to ask me questions as well, if there's things and stuff that come up. But if you're ready for it, we can jump into the first one here.
Yeah, I think we're ready.
Okay. Describe a moment in your life that felt like a scene from a movie.
I think I'm going to skip. I don't know enough movies.
A book. Or a book. You could pick a book or a comic book.
Yeah, I got to skip. I don't know. Yeah. I don't have a good answer. Sorry, Bill.
We'll move on. No worries. Okay, we'll move on. No worries.
We're not that excited.
Describe a small act of kindness that ended up making a big impact on you.
Questions. They aren't like, isn't this supposed to be like, what's your favorite food? All right. A small act of kindness. You know, I think in elementary school, I had this one teacher that she took me aside and told me to keep being a nerd. And I think at that, you know, 10 years old, I needed that encouragement that being a nerd was okay. And I'm still a nerd to this day. So I think that you know, that education, I think, is important, that positive role model.
Yeah, I don't know if this counts as an act of kindness, but I really heard some encouraging words from some of our participants who were really fond about our approach to rehabilitation. So this is definitely something that is very important for me, because it keeps me motivated in the research I'm doing.
That's great. What's the most unusual job you've ever had, and what have you learned from it?
I don't know if this is unusual, but I used to be a personal trainer, and what I've learned from it is that I don't like to be a personal trainer.
He's really good at counting to 10, though. I think, you know, my most unusual job, in high school, I actually had the opportunity to teach karate. So that was what, you know, I've been in the movement space for a long time. I just kept trying to learn about it. So that's where my background is. But I did the traditional thing. I started off like cleaning the school, cleaning the toilets, and slowly moving up to teaching. So
makes sense. What is a childhood hobby or interest that you would just get totally lost in?
I think to this day, because Disney is Disney, I think Star Wars. I don't know if that's a hobby, but I think Star Wars, they keep pulling me in. And now, you know, having my kids watch it with, or I force my kids to watch it with me, I think that's my nerd continuing, but then also pulling in.
I think for me, it was mainly playing outside. That's perhaps one of the things that motivated me to pursue a career in kinesiology, or at least starting from kinesiology.
Just always being in movement. Yeah. The bow tie, hopefully, is a moniker enough. Card-carrying geek/nerd. We just went to Disneyland, and my son made one of those droids, and he loves the thing. Like,
yep.
Carries it everywhere. It's in his room. It's always like right there.
Yep. My kids did the reenactment at Disney with, I don't know, there was, you know, something they went out and they dressed like Jedi. They did the Jedi experience. Mm-hmm. I was jealous that it was only for kids, but my wife told me I could not lie about my age on that one.
What is a local, like, hidden gym, or not a hidden, local thing that's close to you guys that, like, if someone came out, you think everyone should visit or do or go eat?
I think Kansas City Barbecue, although my favorite restaurant is Q39. I don't know. Toby wants to chime in on that.
Yeah, my personal favorite is Jack Stack.
Yeah, so we have a disagreement, but Kansas City Barbecue, I think, would be be where you'd go. When we have you out here, that's where we'll take you.
Yeah, second that. Right.
Unless you're vegetarian, then it gets awkward, but we'll figure that out.
No, I'm not. My daughter is, but we still make it work. What has been your favorite age to be a rehab professional so far?
I'll go. Right now, I'm having a great time. You know, I do my own research, but then also mentoring, you know, junior researcher. That really, I'm really enjoying that stage of it. It's, although stressful, but I love that, where I am right now. Toby doesn't have a favorite age.
Toby.
He's waiting for it.
All right. One last question. Pretend you have a time machine. What does your future self come back to advise you about today?
I'm looking forward to my future self telling me how the craziness of the federal government and biomedical research gets sorted out. You might want to cut that from the podcast, but that's my answer.
Yeah, well, that's a good one. Toby?
Yeah, no, for me, I think it's just maybe just a little piece of advice of taking it easier, that it's going to be okay even if work gets stressful.
Makes sense. Questions for me?
How did you select this paper for the podcast?
So there's a few different ways that paper gets selected. Sometimes the board or the journal group says, we want to really promote this research. We want to pick this thing. Some of it is me saying, ooh, this was interesting, or they're using tech, or they kind of know that I'm a neuro rehab physician and I like the tech stuff. So sometimes that flows into it. And sometimes it's we start with like a list, and then we start asking people, and then it's who can actually make this time in the week. So it's kind of a wide gamut. This is one that they picked, and I had kind of said, ooh, this is interesting.
Good deal.
Yeah, so thank you for sharing that.
Jake and Toby's work is a powerful reminder we can intervene in progressive diseases like multiple sclerosis. They're proving that progress doesn't have to mean expensive technology. Sometimes it's as simple as a treadmill, a few sponges, and a low-tech VR system. With thoughtful, human-centered innovation, we can reframe what's possible for our patients. After the break, let's switch gears. I'll be joined by a future physiatrist, Jacob Urbina, who is a fourth-year medical student at McGovern Medical School, UT Health, Houston. He will talk about a very different kind of tool shaping the future, artificial intelligence. And trust me, you'll want to hear what Jacob has uncovered about how AI might be carrying hidden biases against the very people we serve as rehabilitation clinicians.
Biases beget biases. And the AI is imperfect because by nature we have been imperfect. And we are introducing our texts and we are introducing our thoughts into the system, so it only knows what we've given it.
Jacob's right. AI doesn't create itself in a vacuum. It's built by humans, trained on our data, and as a result, inherits our biases. With that in mind, how does bias, particularly against people with disabilities and impairments, show up in AI models like ChatGPT and Gemini? I found it so interesting to hear Jacob discuss how he approached investigating ability bias in something as complex as AI.
Get ready for the world's largest interdisciplinary rehabilitation research event, ACRM 2025. Join us in Chicago, October 25th to 30th for groundbreaking science, networking, and hands-on learning. Can't make it in person? We've got you covered. Live stream select sessions from anywhere in the world. Plus, our amazing expo hall is free and open to the public October 28th and 29th, featuring the latest rehab innovations. Don't miss it. Register today at acrm.org/2025.
So I think it's very common, especially in just common media, where people with disabilities are not necessarily represented at the same frequency as people without disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered and asked, like, does that still follow up in the same data sets that these large language models have been trained on? And again, what comes in also must come out. And so just trying to observe whether or not the types of text, the types of media, the types of substance that we train these systems on, if that is being spat out in the exact same way. So arguably, it's more of a reflection on what are we giving these systems. And so that's why we took a general approach of just describe a simple person in 5 sentences. And then in that, since it has that localized memory, just ask that same paragraph that it generated, does this person have a disability? Simple yes or no. Mm-hmm. And occasionally it would say, yes, this person has a disability. And more often than not, they would say that they don't have a disability. Then moving forward, we put different qualifiers, common identifiers that can also be attributed to the person. So example, either a person with a disability, a patient with a disability, or an athlete with a disability, to see how those different characteristics and qualifiers change the words that the text used, kind of as a jumping off point or a stem to see, do patients get talked about more unfavorably? Do athletes get more of a positive bias because they're athletes, kind of thing? And again, we performed this semantic analysis or sentiment analysis on the language that these chatbots used in these paragraphs they created. The interesting part of that is oftentimes it was just no, or just would refer back to the text that it said and said to say that, I don't know, I didn't even think to apply that in the original description. Like, it didn't even occur to me that the person that is being described could have had a disability.
I found it interesting when you use those different, I use the term seed terms, where you talked about, you know, person, a patient, athlete. I would not have necessarily had the thought to frame it that way or to try and spur it into generating different things. And I was curious, what went into the thought process to think of those three items, or were you surprised by any of the responses?
So honestly, like, one of the surprising things that came out of the research was that it's pretty comparable to person with disability and athlete with disability. There wasn't that dramatic shift up in the AI that overinflated the favorableness or the favorability, excuse me, of athletes with disability compared to people with disabilities. However, it's still lower than describe a general person without any qualifiers, kind of noting that the introduction of disability to the prompt engineering itself reduces the amount of favorable words that the AI uses in producing these, the subsequent text.
Being a future rehab physician, when you're thinking about even just the term disability, I'm curious if you ran this again, but used a different prompt, a person with an impairment, a person with a handicap, a person with, you know, fill in the blank with some of those other synonymous in the general population to describe, again, an individual, do you think that would have a similar, based on the favorability of the term used to describe the person, would that equate to various levels of, generated text after that?
I think it's an interesting idea to approach, because as the ICF kind of determines, it's, we've started working really hard to change these definitions and to make it more impact on, is the impairment necessarily a part of the diagnosis versus a part of the disability versus how does this actually just affect your overall functioning? And because words mean things. And I think as on the professional side, where like we are becoming healthcare providers and we are kind of setting the stage for this is legally a disability, but this is, you're not necessarily defined by disability. How can I make that better for you? I think it's important that as we try to run these on different words, that we are kind of like those leaders in like shaping what impairment looks like and kind of changing the status quo for the public specifically.
Makes sense. Let's jump into the results a little bit, and we kind of hinted at it, but kind of spell it out for us. So you work with these two various models, you give it these generated prompts, and you have some very beautiful images and tables in your publication, which no one on this podcast can see. So kind of give us, kind of run us through, what did you end up finding as you prompted the large language models with these various prompts?
Yeah. So the first question again was just, does the AI talk about disability at all? And so we created 60 imaginary AI generated people and description of them in 5 sentences, and then just ask, does this person have a disability, yes or no? And with the ChatGPT group of 60 people, they only identified three having a disability in that collection, coming at about 5% of the people having a disability. And for Gemini, it was Bard at the time. It technically didn't say that anyone had a disability, but seven had the possibility of disability, having a population rate of about 11.7%. I mean, compare that to the United States population, which is close to 25% disability. We find that it's vastly underestimating. It's almost excluding the act of so many people being in its population, and kind of rewriting that story to prefer people without disabilities in its text generation.
It is.
And then moving on to more of the sentiment analysis, we identified in the text itself favorable words and limiting words. And so we used the Lexicoder Sentiment Dictionary to kind of define what words were more positive, had more positive connotations. So example, like radiant, inspirational, unwavering, kind of the like AI buzzwords that you'll hear more often than not. And then limiting words, talking about like despite limitations, challenges, obstacles, to see how much is being discussed in, hey, you have a disability, this is only and will only have limiting factors, right? Instead of necessarily that nuance. And when we plug those numbers in with proportion of favorable to entire, let me retake this.
You're fine.
When we studied the paragraphs as a proportion of favorable words to the actual word count of the paragraph that it created, for people without any description of ability status, just describe a person, they had a favorability in ChatGPT with 26.9%. But as soon as you added the characteristic of with a disability, a person with a disability, it dropped down to 22%. It dropped down to 22% for person with disability and athlete with disability. Patients with disability in ChatGPT had the worst favorable density, so to speak, at 13%, kind of alluding to the fact that not only does disability reduce the number of favorable descriptions of the person, the act of being a patient also comes with its own connotation as well.
I mean, that makes sense based on what I assume what was inputted into the models, which is the common lexicon that presumably carries some inherent or implicit bias in just what was used to generate these. If you were in the room as these models were being crafted or initially engineered or as they continue to develop, what are the potential avenues that you could help bring the results closer to the reality of people in the population with varying levels of impairments, or making what is generated a little bit more broadly true?
Yeah. I think it's important to also consider that just because the addition of disability exists in these prompts doesn't mean you have to take out the favorable qualities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really more where our commentary on the state of AI is coming from, is that you don't have to remove language discussing like how nice a person is or how strong or how well-spirited a person is just because you have inputted an extra addition to their prompt or an extra identifier to their functional status. People are people regardless of if they have a diagnosis or not. And I think making sure that that's at the forefront of creating these systems that create text, and for people outside of medicine, like creating characters or creating spaces and artistic and creating things with artistic license, that there's more to people than just, oh, because you have a disability, therefore I have to speak more to the disability rather than to the person. And if I were in this room discussing and working through this, it'd be working with people with disabilities to see exactly what that language looks like for them. Because again, it's a very personal experience. I myself am a finger amputee. And so that also kind of spurs on this sense of like disability advocacy and justice, is that people who have the right to be in the spaces and the right to help design these systems should have their voice also spoken in shaping what that looks like for people down the road.
And including the various levels of identification a person has with a given impairment, you know? I'll use your example. I'm a person with a finger impairment. I'm a finger impairment patient. Like, there's different ways to frame that archetype that then inevitably carries different weight when you enter the public space, when you enter the medical field, when you enter that, you know, trusted, ideally trusted space with your healthcare provider.
Of course.
Where do you see, like, what is the question after this? Like, without giving away potentially another paper you're working on, but like, where would you like to see more things happen kind of in the same vein? I think a repeat would be very interesting. It's also hard to be a rehab clinician of any type and not have a little bit of that inherent optimistic forward vision, because otherwise, you know, it's hard to work with someone with where they're at if you don't think they can improve or that things can get better. So it's kind of baked into us, I feel like. do you have questions for me before we kind of close out or think about next steps and moving into the lightning round?
Let me think. Like, is questions for the podcast or questions about
whatever?
One of the things that we could also consider is just, what are those other C words, right? And identities that people hold, and how does that affect them? Like, how, like, describe for me a student with a disability, and describe for me a friend with a disability, a mother, and just what are these qualities? I think, as again, part of this is education. Like, these systems are used in all aspects of teaching, from high school to graduate school, and it's going to be a fundamental part of how we use these devices, and will inform likely our research endeavors. I think there was a fun paper a couple years ago that tracked how often research papers had these like AI buzzwords in them to see like, it has that been found its way into our into academia. Thankfully, this was 100% human written.
Good clause.
But I think it's going to be interesting to watch moving forward. Ooh, for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good. So, other questions and things?
I think this has been great. No questions.
Okay. I'm going to switch into the lightning round here. Okay. No big like sound effect. We'll put it in after, but there's typically like a thunder boom, like boom. these are really not meant to be scary or anything. They're just trying to get to know the people behind the research that gets put out.
Of course.
You can pass on any of these, like just trying to give you a little bit more three-dimensional piece for the listeners. Describe a moment in your life that felt like a movie, or sorry, describe a moment in your life that felt like a scene from a movie.
Oh, I mean, you're catching me at a good time. I just got married this weekend out in the hill country. We had a beautiful wildflower wedding. The gusts literally looked windswept over my wife's hair. And at one point we just got our photos back, like a little sneak peek photos back. Her veil had fallen off into the wind, and it really just looked cinematic. I can't describe it any other way.
Perfect. Well, I'm glad I asked that question. describe a small act of kindness that made a big impact on you.
Yep. And can I actually think on this one?
Yeah, sure.
I've been very fortunate that there have been a lot of very small acts of kindness throughout the way. It's really, really hard to nail down a specific one.
Sure.
I have one. Actually coming through medical school, kind of call it like small act of kindness, kind of call it fate. There were two positions available for one of the technology roles, like as a job to work during medical school, where like I was in charge of recording the lectures for people who were unable to attend class for whatever reason, kind of like a hybrid lecture system. And the first person said, oh, maybe let me think on the job. And then I was the third person that our boss interviewed. And it's like, hey, like, it's yours if you want it. Just give me a commitment. And I said, yeah, I'd love to do it. And it had propagated to so much great things. I made some of the best friends in like educational technology systems, knowing how to kind of do things similar to this, where creating content for audio listeners in a way that is engaging and entertaining, to the point that I'm actually one of the podcast hosts for AAP's Pocket Mentor podcast.
I'm aware.
And just having these experiences that really kind of not only make you feel warm inside, but like give you like skills to like be a better communicator.
That's one thing I didn't fully appreciate entering this role, is how much faster I could connect with patients based on the questions I was asking, and how it's helped me become a better listener in the room with people, and try and break, it's still there, but break that cycle of, I got to get out in so much time, I got to hit these things, it's got to be in this order, otherwise my notes are jumbled. Like, it's made me a better clinician going through this process.
Yeah, the two things, humility and curiosity, I feel. Mm-hmm. I've always been a big fan of playing like I need to know the information. Like I have zero background. Like let me ask all the questions.
That's good. Yeah. And off the record, if you want to flip the roles, you just let me know.
Absolutely.
Podcast takeover. What is the most unusual job you've ever had, and what did you learn from it? You kind of hinted at one. We can move on. Or
no,
if you got a good one.
I have a great one for you.
Okay, let's hear it.
So I'm originally from a very small town in East Texas, and through that town runs the Texas State Railroad. For two winter breaks, I was a singing, dancing chef on the Polar Express that ran through the Texas State Railroad. It was arguably one of the best jobs I have ever experienced. It was so much fun to spark joy and to share in kind of that magic. And arguably like learn how to work well on a team. We did 5 shows a night, and just getting that pace down of like, hey, how to think quick on your feet, how to do things safely. All that kind of stuff. I would stand by going back to the Polar Express.
Yeah. Wouldn't wish this on you, but yeah, the whole doctor thing doesn't work out. Maybe you make it a national tour.
Oh yeah.
What childhood hobby or interest did you have that you would just get totally lost in?
I loved solving Rubik's Cubes very, very quickly. I had a couple friends in high school who, like, we all, like, challenged each other to see who can solve Rubik's Cubes the fastest. And I had just developed, like, this collection of, like, all the weird shapes and all the different types of cube patterns. I think I got it to 30 seconds. It's not as good as it could be, but for 14 years old, it was fine.
Yeah, my son is a spin cuber and 10 and loves it. He's not super fast. We're still learning all the other unique ways to make him faster, but he it's just one of those funny things that he just loves to pull out once in a while.
Oh, yeah.
What is a local hidden gem in your community that you think everyone should visit or go to?
Oh, that's a great question. Houston has a very fun food scene. It's really, really difficult to pick one specific place that I'd say, like, you have to go to.
Is it, like, part of town?
I mean, it's literally, it's everywhere. Oh, let me think. I do have to actually think on this one because it's pretty extensive. Let me think. There was a recent place. Oh. What's it called? Do you mind if I look this up real quick?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah. Okay. I actually just got introduced to this place not too long ago. It's a kind of like an Italian food spot in Houston. And you wouldn't necessarily think like Italian food for Houston, which is like why like it's kind of been hard to come by. But Milton's in Houston, it's like in the like Montrose Midtown area. Very, very high class, super entertaining, and honestly some of the best food I've ever had in my life.
Sounds good. I'll put it on my list. Pretend you have a time machine. What does your future self come back and advise you about?
What is my future self? Okay, this is different because I was thinking past. Honestly, I think it would be the same answer for future and past, is that just keep doing what you're doing. I think for me that everything has been lined up in such a way that I'm very fortunate each and every step. Like, I think back to my own amputation, and I would never change a thing. I think every single good thing in my life has come after it. It pushed me into biomedical engineering, to do prosthetic design, to do PM&R. I met my wife, who's a brain injury speech pathologist. Like, I think everything continues to happen and blossom, and I'm really just looking forward to seeing where that path takes me.
Me too. I'll be excited to see where you take it and what comes next.
Thank you.
It has been a pleasure. Are there questions for me, things for me, stuff on your mind?
Not as far as this podcast goes, but if you do have the availability within the future, we would love to have you on Pocket Mentor.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you probably heard one of the most recent episodes about the other fellows, I think now attendings potentially, who went through neurocritical care fellowship after PM&R as well. And so if you have any other insights kind of leading into that, it'd be great to connect and get you on the podcast.
Sure. Absolutely.
From the physical to the digital, today's episode showed us that rehab innovation come in many forms. Jake and Toby showed us how something as simple as a treadmill walking can be transformed into a powerful intervention for multiple sclerosis. While Jacob is challenging us to think deeply about how AI reflects and sometimes can reinforce the biases we bring to the table. Both conversations remind us that we have the power to shape the future of the field of rehabilitation. Thank you for joining us today on the ACRM Rehabcast. I'd love to hear from you, your thoughts, feedback, and what topics you're interested in for future episodes. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you're listening. It really helps amplify and celebrate the incredible world of rehabilitation. I'm Dr. Bill Niehaus. Follow me on social media at NHAUSMD. Special thanks to the ACRM team who produced this episode and to the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder for the Rehabcast music. And now for the mandated promotional material in the style of dogs barking. If you're not a dog person, that was a request to join us at the next ACRM conference, October 27th to the 30th, 2025 in Chicago. See you there!